Hello, everybody. My name is Larry Jacobs. This is Pre-K-12 Education Talk Radio on June 1st, 2022. Hey, we all made it. Okay, it's June, and happy June, everybody. It's great to have you here today for the show, and you might be listening afterwards. We know a lot of people do that on the podcast. That's the nature of podcasting, and you should know that we archive everything over at ace-ed.org. That's our home website, the Consortium for Equity in Education, ace-ed.org, and our magazine is over there. That's called Equity and Access Pre-K-12. It's online. Just click on the cover. SELtoday.org is over there. Our website on teacher retention, teacher-retention.com. A ton of articles and also, obviously, all the podcasts, again, at ace-ed.org. And we are very honored today to have a very special guest. I have to thank my good friends over at the Council of Chief State School Officers and also in the state of Maryland, okay, Laura Redkowski, for helping me get the state superintendent of Maryland to take time away from his busy day to be with us today. Mohammed Chaudhuri, which I hope I'm pronouncing right, okay. Superintendent Chaudhuri, welcome to the show, and how am I doing with your last name?
Hi, Larry. Thank you for having me. It's close. It's Chaudhuri. So, Chaudhuri. Chaudhuri.
Thank you. Can I call you Mohammed, or what do you prefer?
Mohammed is fine. Yeah.
Do you like that one? We can do with that. Okay.
Yeah, Mohammed is fine. You know, my parents gave me one of the most common names in the world, so it's good to say.
They did? If not the most common name in the world, I think it might very well be. And, you know, that's what I want to start there first. I just have to say something. You are a first-generation American. Okay, your parents, mm-hmm. I read this. Your parents, congratulations. I mean, your parents came over from Bangladesh, okay? Mm-hmm. And here you are, Maryland's chief state school officer. And so just what's your background? Just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
You
know, go have it.
I was, thank you, Larry. So, you know, I grew up born and raised in Los Angeles. My parents immigrated to Los Angeles in around the 70s. And, you know, they settled literally in the heart of L.A. And when I say heart of L.A., imagine where – you know, Hollywood Boulevard and all of that is. And so we literally, my brothers and I, grew up there. I went to all.
Were you in Westwood? No.
Westwood is actually way away from where Hollywood is. So I'm more so, imagine where, like, you know, where the Walk of Fame and all everything you know
like
about
Like Grauman's
Hollywood
Chinese
Boulevard,
Theater. Grauman's Chinese.
Exactly.
Got it. Okay.
So
got it.
My family's actually apartments that we lived on was actually right next to, not too far away from where the Chinese theater was is. And so, you know, and Hollywood during the 80s and 90s was a different place than what it is now. But overall, you know, that's where I grew up. You know, I grew up around, I often like to say, zero Bangladeshi people, zero, hardly any Muslim people. I went to all Title I schools. I often say I grew up amongst blacks, Mexicans, and Koreans. Those
Beautiful.
Were pretty much all of my friends. And I was,
Beautiful.
You know, the only Bengali. I was the only Bengali kid in the classroom because my older brother is a few years older than me, so we didn't really get to go to school together in terms of the grade bands. And so that was all of my life. I spent you know, in Title I schools from elementary, middle, high school. And
wow.
Why I jumped into education is because I took a trip between, you know, you finish fifth grade. And you go up into sixth grade, and my family took my brother and I to Bangladesh, and it was our first trip. So, you know, we were, I like to describe ourselves as like spoiled American kids, relatively
yep.
speaking. When you go to other nations, you realize, you know, certain privileges you have. So we went to Bangladesh, and my parents grew up along with my grandparents in, like, the far regions of Bangladesh from where the capital is, which is Dhaka,
right.
Modern, Yep, which is a more modern city, relatively speaking, and you have to take a train, and so the train is like 5, 6, 7 hours away. The train broke down. I remember we had to get out of the train. We had to walk it. Experience was a big deal for me because we ended up visiting where my, you know, grandparents and parents grew up, and in that village, education in Bangladesh was not something that was allowable and available. I'll say allowable and available to everyone. It was often seen that it was reserved for the elite. And so my grandfather decided to say, screw that, I'm just going to build a school. And so he just built a school in their village. I mean, and it was literally just four walls. It was four walls, you know, and I just thought it was the most at that age, I thought it was the coolest, most, you know, like amazing story just because, like, you know, one, it had an aura of defying, you know, a system that was not clearly designed to benefit all. And it was also something to really empower a community with knowledge. And so ultimately, you know, I just remember just stepping into those four walls. I'm like, I want to build schools. That's what I want to do. I want to build schools. And I set on the journey to become a teacher. And then ultimately I got, so I was a teacher in Los Angeles. I'm a graduate of UCLA's teacher education program, which has a strong focus on, which has a strong focus on placing its candidates in South LA as well as East LA. And I did my entire teaching career in those neighborhoods. I was a middle school person, and I did some high school, but middle school is where I spent most of my time. And then I ultimately got tired of central office and the bureaucrats in downtown messing things up. And I said, I got to be in those rooms. And I told myself, I got to be in those rooms. And so I set on the journey to go do that. And I ended up in Texas. I did a lot of work out in Dallas and San Antonio. A lot
you
of
did great work out
statewide.
There. Don't wait a minute. Wait, Mohammed, don't sell yourself short. You did great work in both Dallas and San Antonio. Let me
thank
just
you.
Make that
thank
point.
You, thank
You're
you.
Welcome.
Yes. No, it really showed me what is possible regardless of political climate, right? You can get people bought in around. I often like to say you got to have an independent purple heart to really get it right for kids. And so I got to really groom those skills in Texas, I say. And then, you know, as I said, I was like, well, I really want to figure this out at the state level. And so I'd love to be a state superintendent. And, you know, Maryland just this opportunity unveiled itself. And I threw my hat in, and the State Board of Education said,
"There you are.
Let's change it up. Let's bring an outsider in, and let's change it up." And here
that's great.
I am, a state superintendent. And I'm wrapping
and,
up.
An outsider with all that experience in urban education, having gone through it yourself, okay, and also understanding what it's like to be in a very diverse school world. Okay, I think it's wonderful. And I just have to ask you to show off a little bit. Did you go to Hollywood High School?
No, I actually went to its rival, Fairfax High School, which is not that far from there. Yeah, but you either end up in Hollywood or Fairfax. I would have ended up at Fairfax. I'm sorry, I would have ended up Hollywood, but we moved. And so I went to Fairfax. So there's a healthy rival, but Hollywood definitely has the more legendary stories of you know,
they do.
Of celebrities and such who have gone through the system.
Right, and I never forgot a friend of mine, years ago he stopped doing this, but a friend of mine was a football coach, high school football coach. I can't remember what school he was at, but he took me to a game one time, and it was at Hollywood, you know, when we were both older. He was a coach, and I was his guest at a game, and I never forgot the team name, the mascot of the Hollywood High School was the Sheiks, like Rudolph Valentino, the Sheiks. I never forgot. I was going to show off for you, and I'll just do it that way.
Absolutely. They are still the Sheiks, and they have this mural off of Sunset Boulevard that has, you know, all of the Hollywood stars facing the street and everything. It's a legendary high school.
It is. And boy, you were right there, for goodness sakes, okay? And good old Fairfax High. We'll let it go with that. Welcome to Maryland. And you've been there since 2021, right? But you're a year and a half
I started on July 1st, so I'm about to enter my second year. I'm wrapping up my
second
year.
Happy anniversary. We're 11 months literally today, okay?
Yeah.
That's great. So talk about This is kind of fun, this part. Talk about what you walked into, okay? And I like Maryland's good state, okay? Mm-hmm. What's the state of education in Maryland these days? And what did you walk into when you took the job, if I may? Okay? And
absolutely.
By the way, you came in mid-pandemic.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
I did.
Good timing. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Yes. So a couple of things. One, I'll hit on three things. One, Maryland has long had a reputation for being on national rankings, ranked in like the top five, top 10 of education systems. At one point, it was number one. You know, Massachusetts holds that title. And by national rankings, I'm referring to the NAEP, the National Assessment of Education Progress, or the Quality Count reports by Education Week and such. And you know, those rankings and such cut in different ways. But ultimately, Maryland has had that reputation. As the state diversified, however, as you know, we went through the No Child Left Behind era, and there was more accountability around ensuring that equity was front and center, and ensuring that historical gaps were not hidden in averages, as I like to say, and that systems had to have plans to address those gaps. I always do credit No Child Left Behind for putting that on the map, and I don't think we could ever go backwards from that. You could argue about other aspects of the law, but that part was essential. And I would say as that happened, Maryland, you know, and as it diversifies, like, for example, Maryland now has 100,000 English language learners, and it's the fastest growing demographic. Half of the state is approaching Title I, and concentrations of poverty are increasing in parts of Maryland. And so all in all, you know, the state's education system has not evolved to ensure that excellence was actually delivered for all kids, regardless of their standing in life. And so that's one. So I walked into a state that is reckoning with that. And so that.
And by the way, Mohammed, if I may, I'm just curious. Is all of Maryland countywide school districts? I know, like this Baltimore City, you know, Baltimore. How's it set up? Because you came from Texas, where they're all the ISDs.
Yeah.
They're not countywide. Now suddenly you're in countywide.
Yeah.
Just speak on that. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So Texas is 5.5 million children, 1,000 plus districts of all shapes and sizes. So that's Texas. And Maryland is 900,000 students with 24 school systems. 23 of them are 23 of them are counties, and one of them is Baltimore City. So there's a Baltimore County and Baltimore City, and you can trace all that back to the history of redlining and segregation, like most stories. And
why am I laughing?
Know, there's a lot in that. And so 24 school systems. So I often like to say there's only 24. We can figure this out, right? And so it is very important in my role that I ensure that I am actively always engaging all of our school systems and stakeholders.
Mm-hmm.
But they're very diverse, right? The nickname, one of Maryland's nicknames is American Miniature. So from Western Maryland to the shore, to the core, where you have big districts like Montgomery County and Baltimore County, to Southern Maryland, where you have spillover now happening in terms of demographic shifts from D.C. into Charles County and Calvert and St. Mary's.
Right.
Maryland is diverse. And both in landscape and also just ideologically, I would say. So that's the stats of the state. And as I said, walking into a state that has decided to reckon with its inability to evolve its education system to truly serve all kids well. And so one of the things it did, and this is point number two, and I'm going to shift into what is something called the Blueprint for Maryland's Future.
Yep.
And essentially, a commission formed, met for 3 years, and that commission met to essentially study world-class education systems as well as national success stories rigorously. And it was called the Commission on Innovation and Excellence in Education, otherwise known as the Kerwin Commission, because the chair was the former chancellor of the University of Maryland, Britt Kerwin. So it was known as the Kerwin Commission. And they met for 3 years, ultimately led to a massive report that made a set of recommendations, and then it led to the blueprint legislation. And the blueprint legislation passed, and it is now law. I am walking into literally, I started my tenure as year one of the law being active and beginning the work of implementation. I was hired, I went through the interview process and such during spring of 21, and I started on July. And the law passed during that whole time period. And so the blueprint for blueprint legislation, I call it an amazing piece of legislation that truly, and I mean this, I don't think anyone can point to any other legislation that has passed in the country that seeks to tackle so many things at the same time. Of course, there have been major education laws in different states, and they're looking to tackle different aspects of it. Normally, they're just focused on funding and maybe some elements of the educational facets that drive quality, but Maryland's blueprint legislation truly is capturing all aspects. And so when I say that is there are five policy areas in the blueprint: early childhood education, so it's looking to move the state closer to universal pre-K and expand quality in every region of our state. The second policy area is high quality and diverse teachers and leaders, ensuring that we have a strong educator core that is also reflective of our student body. And then the other key piece of that policy area is it's building a statewide career ladder. So it's elevating teacher pay, moving starting pay to $60,000 while also creating a career ladder. While also creating a career ladder similar to some international systems that essentially create like these hybrid roles that allow teachers to highly effective teachers to expand their reach while also making more, but also keeping them connected to the classroom in smart ways. So that's the high quality and diverse teachers and leaders. The third policy area is college and career readiness. This is where everything converges. And really the commission looked at international models for this. So the vision around Blueprint is every student by the end of 10th grade will be college and career ready, similar to, I'll point to, for example, in Switzerland or Germany, where you have students who are become college ready by 10th grade, college and career ready by 10th grade, and then they choose a pathway. Do they want to go into the workforce and jump in through rigorous apprenticeships, or do they want to go pursue other more levels of higher education in a college degree or advanced degrees? And so the blueprint really envisions Maryland's education system transforming itself around that model. So right now I have commissioned, per the blueprint law, a major study to look at and study our existing rules, policies, and laws all the way up to higher education and down to K-12 to see what is needed to ultimately define what college and career readiness should mean for our state. The fourth big policy bucket is more resources to ensure that all students are successful. So this ensures that it is increasing its per pupil allotments. It is being more progressive with its English language learner weights and special education weights. It is also that policy area has also created something called concentration of poverty grants, which essentially leads to the creation of community schools and ensuring wraparound services are available for our kids. And then finally, the fifth policy area is governance and accountability. And that one essentially is what it sounds like. It's ensuring that the state has smart and tight accountability systems for the billions of dollars that will be invested over the next 10 years to get this right. And I'll leave you with my third and final point is I inherited a department that is not yet built for the blueprint. And so there's a clear mandate to the leader that they chose, and I knew this both coming in my research as well as competing for the job, to get this right. So design a State Department of Ed built for the blueprint, that is engaging, that is leading, that is felt each and every day as a supportive and positive force for change for our kids and for our school systems. And so that's what I walked into.
I had my mic on mute for a second. Okay, you walked into an actual interesting situation because they gave you a blueprint. They gave you a blueprint.
Exactly. Literally.
Okay.
Literally.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people walk into a situation. Now what? Okay. But you had this thing. Okay. So now I have to ask you some questions about it. All right. I love early childhood education. Who doesn't like that? Everybody loves that. All right. I love the fact that they're saying that, if I heard you correctly, the starting salary for a teacher is going to be $60,000.
Yep, moving it up.
Is that real? Okay, you got to get it up there because we are really, and you know this, we're having trouble finding teachers. Okay,
absolutely.
And I always use the example, my niece, who just graduated last year from the University of Massachusetts, bright kid, et cetera, et cetera. She walked out and got a job at a human resources department of a biotech company, $62,000 a year at age 22, okay, and with no experience in that at all. And my complaint has always been the school districts can't compete with that. All right?
Mm-hmm.
And so why, you know, kids are going to go into a private industry as opposed to school districts. So if you guys can guarantee a $60,000 a year minimum to start, which is comparable to a solid professional having graduated college going into the private sector, okay, I think that's fabulous. Okay? I think that's just great.
Absolutely, and you're going to also like this aspect. And not only are we looking, we will move the starting salary to $60,000, but within the first 5 to 7 years of a teacher's career, they can begin to already make 80 or above. That's what
fabulous.
We're trying to head to.
That's fabulous.
Yeah. Not wait,
okay.
Not wait 30 years, not wait 20 years to get there. Yeah.
Thank you.
Exactly.
That's so important. Yeah. Or people will leave, or they won't even come in. I mean,
absolutely.
Advertise that. You know, it's really cool. The other thing is, and this is a real challenge, you want high-quality people to come into education. But we also want those high-quality people to be diverse, whatever they might
absolutely.
Be. Okay? Gender, race, whatever you want to talk about. Okay? And it's hard to find. Okay?
Absolutely.
How are we going to do that? Mohammed, talk to me.
Yeah.
How are we going to get those wonderful, diverse groups into education?
Absolutely.
We need it more than ever.
One aspect of it you and I have already hit upon is making sure the pay is very competitive, making sure the journey to becoming a teacher is seamless, making sure you can even also reduce and subsidize, if not eliminate, debt for people who become teachers. I think those are all important things.
Yeah.
So one, making sure the experience of becoming a teacher is highly supportive, making sure the when teachers have to, you know, when candidates have to accrue debt, that we can subsidize that, if not eliminate it, with their commitment to becoming a teacher, and then ultimately they jump into a career that can definitely pay a solid middle-class wage that enables them to focus on teaching and not worry about it. So that's one aspect of it. The second
you'll love this one.
Yeah,
you'll love this. I was just reading yesterday. Yeah, I think, was it Ed Week? I can't even remember. No, it was something with North Carolina. Several of the districts in North Carolina are offering housing to get them to come in.
Yep.
Okay.
Oh,
so
no, you can't even imagine what that looks like. I mean, can you imagine being a teacher in San Francisco and what
no,
looks like that?
No, I can't.
Exactly.
Yeah,
so,
who can afford it?
I mean, yeah, exactly. And so those are some things we have to figure out, that piece, and I'm excited that our state is committed to doing that. The second one is one, you want to attract diverse candidates to your state. So Maryland is a high import state. So 50% of our teaching force is filled from out of state candidates. So
Interesting.
50%. So, one, I hope to steal and convince all diverse teachers to come here. That's one. These are already grown-up teachers who are teachers working in various places. But the second one is a long long game strategy. And it's something I have made a priority of mine. I have used my federal ESSER dollars, and I would be happy to talk to you about something called Maryland Leads. It's a grant initiative.
I was going to ask you about it. Segue right in there.
Yeah.
Maryland Leads
is a $150 million grant initiative that I created using our state set aside. So we pushed down all the money that needs to be pushed down to the districts. Then we had a set aside. I could have done different things with it, but I said, you know what? Let me use this in my first year to really kickstart conversations and initiatives that I know are really important for us to triple, quadruple down in long term. And so what we did is create Maryland Leads using our federal set aside. It's a $150 million grant initiative, and essentially it's designed around seven strategies. One of those seven strategies, and I will just talk about this for now given the question that you asked me, is Grow Your Own. And what Grow Your Own essentially does is what it sounds like. It's ensuring that school systems in partnership with higher institutions of higher ed can design experiences for their staff, for their students to become their future teachers. I am proud to say that all of our school systems have committed to the Grow Your Own strategy.
That's good.
And so imagine teaching assistants and helping them achieve a bachelor's degree to ultimately becoming a teacher while also paying for their schooling throughout and supporting them. Students who are jumping into a early college high school model that is focused on giving them dual credit while earning an associate's and ultimately coming back with a bachelor's to be a teacher in their system, because the student population is much more diverse than the adult population. And their support staff are also more diverse than the teaching core. And so this Grow Your Own investment is a big deal. And so one of the things that I want to do, like we did in Texas, there's a permanent Grow Your Own fund that essentially launched and funds Grow Your Owns in perpetuity. And I hope to use this Maryland Leads conversation to convince our assembly and stakeholders to enable me to create a permanent fund. And so I'm going to get some early wins through districts committing to design Grow Your Own programs, but I hope to use that narrative to ultimately hook the state on a permanent one. So that's how you get them. So that would be my answer to your question around how do you diversify the profession.
Yeah. And that's a great way to do it. And you forgot the most important thing, that you have to tell these kids, that if they come back there and become a teacher in the district, they get to call their teachers by their first names. That's very important.
That is very important. In addition to if they stay for several years, we'll wipe out their debt. I think that one's good.
That's also important. That's also important, and that's so key. All right, it really is, and that is just great. How are we doing? This year is probably the worst year ever, and God, you came from San Antonio. Okay, Uvalde's close enough to San Antonio to talk about that horror last week.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
this was a stressful year for educators. You know the statistic: 50% of educators are thinking of leaving the profession.
Yep.
That's not good right off the bat. I hope everybody who's listening stays. Okay, so the movement, and we even started a website about it. We're building it up as we speak, teacher-retention.com. Okay, we really want teachers to stay in the field. How's teacher retention doing in Maryland?
Yeah, so I like to have this conversation in a more nuanced manner. So, yes, it is true that the surveys are showing that people are having a tough time. When I did my opening letter for Maryland Leads, I said, you know, the data is clear that our students and staff are not doing okay. And I mean that wholeheartedly.
And you mean it in a good sense. You mean it from the heart. Yeah.
One of these seven strategies along with Grow Your Own is staff support and retention. And that's specifically designed to enable school systems to do a deep needs assessment on what they can do both culturally, financially, structurally to keep their teachers in their system. And so that is as simple as one-time bonuses to enabling them to have more, and as complex as reducing their workload, giving them more planning time, all of those things. So that is something, that is one of the seven strategies. But the, in terms of retention in Maryland, I do want to, so we have had actually pretty good retention over the years. It's been 90%, 90% of our teachers stay, and that has held steady in the pandemic. That has held steady in the pandemic. Where you see issues is when I've been walking, when I've been visiting schools across the state, and I talk to the principals, and one of the first questions I ask is, are you fully staffed? And, you know, many are saying they are. It's in their support roles where they have some vacancy, like teaching assistants and other hard-to-fill areas. Also, they don't have deep pools like they used to. So maybe they might have had 50 candidates or 30 candidates for that algebra position, but they only got 10, right? And the other element to that is, so that's one. So it's not like we're out of the water around that, because if you don't have a pool and a pipeline, then you're in trouble long term. The second thing is, our high-poverty neighborhoods, high-poverty schools, schools in West Baltimore, schools in rural areas, they've always had a tough time in retaining and recruiting high-quality teachers, as well as veteran teachers and keeping them. And so that has only been exacerbated by the pandemic. And so, so when we talk about this crisis, yes, there is a crisis, and I have said to my board members last board meeting a couple of weeks ago, I said, we need a Marshall Plan for the teaching profession, and I mean that. But ultimately, you know, we've needed a Marshall Plan for high-poverty schools and teachers. We have. And so and rural areas that have a tougher time. So that has that challenge still exists and has been exacerbated even further. So I just that's how we're doing. But overall, our state has had a 90% retention rate.
That's pretty
and that
good.
Has held steady. That has held steady. Yeah.
That's pretty darn good. Okay, and you're right about the high-poverty schools, et cetera. And, you know, which brought me to another question. You had said that the state, this always scares me, calls for more resources for schools. All right?
Yep.
And the challenges, and I feel a lot, particularly in special education, all these mandates come down from the states or from the feds, okay, that you have to do this, you have to do that, and they don't give them the money to do it. Okay? So when they say more resources, are they really going to give them more resources? That's the simplest question in the world. Yeah, go ahead.
That is a great question. So one of the things, the way the money is designed in the blueprint is the districts get it, but there is no, how do I say it, you have to use it on X, Y, and Z. You get the money, your English language learners generate the dollars, you get the per pupil base, you get the special education dollars, you get the, you know, the concentration of poverty grant, you get it all in this bulk. You as a district in your school community can design it. You can, what is known as braided funding, you can braid funding in creative ways. And I have told school system superintendents, and I have told principals especially, I tell the principals usually in front of the superintendents when I visit the schools, I said, hey, if you have an amazing idea and someone tells you that State Superintendent Mohammed Chaudhry won't allow it because the state doesn't, then you call me up and you tell me, because I'm going to tell you that they're not telling the truth, because I have not even heard your idea, and I will give you whatever waivers you need or whatever flexibility if it's a great idea. The money has to be, you have to be, allow people to be flexible with it. Now, on the back end, when it's time to report out to our public for transparency and reporting's sake, then they have to show how did you use the money for English language learners, special education students, et cetera. But on the front end, it's coming in with a lot of opportunity to be flexible with it. Now, the challenge is I have to strike the right balance between, as I like to say, is guardrails and innovation, right? How do I strike the right balance? And provide guidance on that. So that's the challenge. That's the challenge I have before me. But I love that challenge. As a former chief strategy and innovation officer who always loved pushing the boundaries and driving my CFOs crazy, I'm excited about this.
Right. I love that. That's a great analogy with the guardrails. Okay, in terms of innovation, we want it, but we have to keep it somehow within a border somewhere. I love that. A part of your Maryland leads, and I have the list here, which really struck me, is reimagining the use of time. All right, and time is that's the big factor. You know, teachers are pressed for time, educators are pressed for time, but we've been having this school day. I'll make it up from 8 a.m. till 3:30 in the afternoon or whatever. Okay, for the last 12 million years. All right, and you know, everybody all of a sudden had to work at home. Time didn't matter that much. I feel like H.G. Wells with a time machine here. When you say reimagining the use of time, what do you mean? I think that's great that we can do that. But what does that mean when you say that? Yeah.
Absolutely. So one of the things that if you dig into the Maryland Leads guidebook, there's a strategy page. So there's in the reimagining use of time, there are several points on how I want school systems to think about time and the challenge before them through the Maryland Advance. So it is everything from restructuring the schedule to allow more occurrences of tutoring, mentorship, service learning, career and college exploration, or social and emotional supports. It is about reimagining the use of time so teachers can get more contact time with one another so they can plan and support each other in planning excellent lessons. It's about creating time where we can take accomplished teachers and expand their reach so they can truly mentor the future core of teachers that are coming. It is about getting creative with how you do summer programming and extend that out the school year.
Yep.
And for students, it is about if you want to completely redo the calendar and restructure it from a non-traditional way, that is the canvas is yours to paint on. And so and it is everything from, hey, why don't we go ahead and find opportunities for students to do more real work applied to real world settings, right? Really high quality project-based learning. And if that requires them to spend time differently and still meet the compliance requirements of what a school day counts as, it is all of that. And so that is essentially, that is the bucket that I have the most flexibility around, where I told them to really dream big.
They should dream big.
Yes,
I always say, and everybody, probably everybody's screaming and yelling at me, okay, if you could end school in June, a lot of school districts do, but then, and again, pay them for this, have the teachers come in for 3 weeks in July without the kids, okay, and just professional development, conversation, breaking down silos, okay, and just use 3 weeks of time that are quiet without discipline issues, without class.
Mm-hmm.
I think it'd be brilliant. I just think, you know, we have to do it.
That's the one big difference between international systems and our country is they get a lot of time to be able to plan and work and also are able to depend on us on a network of wraparound services for their kids in a reliable way. Our teachers are not able to do that consistently in our country, and they have to fill those voids in addition to teaching. I often say, you're going to like this line. I often get in trouble because my wife thinks I don't come off too polished when I say it, but I'll go ahead and say it. I say I was a damn good teacher because I was also a damn good social worker on most days.
There you go. I love it.
Yeah.
Love it. And, you know, we have got to look at changes. And, you know, I hate to say this. The pandemic, as horrible as it was, please do not underestimate that, okay?
Yep.
It gives us the opportunity to make a change.
Absolutely.
And if we don't take advantage of it, we're going to really miss that boat, and we have to. You and I are going to go. I hope you'll come back on. Mohammed, this was wonderful. You're really doing a great job down there.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Larry. I really appreciate you just giving me the time to share what we're doing.
You're always welcome.
Thank you so much, and you have a safe and week, and I'll look forward to meeting you one day again soon. Thank you.
We will do that. Thank you. Thank you, Mohammed. Have a great safe time, and good luck with everything. I wish you the best.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So much. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Well, that, everybody, wow, what a great guy. That's the chief state school officer of the great state of Maryland. Okay, that's Mohammed Chaudhuri. Mohammed Chaudhuri. I'm going to get that right. Mohammed Chaudhuri, okay, the chief state school officer, state superintendent of schools in the great state of Maryland. And I'll tell you, he's a story in and of himself. And he did do a great job in Dallas, a great job in San Antonio. They've got him up here running the state. The state is supporting education as Maryland kind of does, okay? And great governor right down there, et cetera. So we can look to Maryland, all right? They got a good future ahead of them. Well, that was great. And I got to thank my good friends over at the Council of Chief State School Officers. Thank you, Carolyn, over there for putting this together. And Laura Ratkowski down in Maryland, thank you for helping me so much with getting the show together. All right, Mohammed, again, thanks to you. We're going to archive the show at ace-ed.org. Please go over, see all the stuff we do. My name's Larry Jacobs. Thanks for listening.